Thank you for tuning in to the second day in the second week of IGH 260, a five-year-long study of the New Testament brought to you by International Gospel Hour. We are working our way through each of the 260 chapters in the New Testament, studying one chapter per week. We recently finished Matthew chapter 1, and today we continue our study of Matthew chapter 2. Today's broadcast then, week 2, lesson 2. A quick reminder as we get started, to learn more about IGH 260 and how you can get all of our free materials, including program downloads, digital books, online and correspondence courses, and more, please take a moment to do one of the following. You can text the word IGHFREE to 55222. That's IGHFREE, all one word. Simply text IGHFREE to 55222. Or you can send an email to free at ighradio.com. And finally, you can also call us toll-free at 1-855-IGH-6988. Let's get into God's Word today. Here's a summary of how we ended our last study. We cited an interesting paragraph from Keener's IVP New Testament Bible Background Commentary, only the last line of which we note here. Even though these magi were pagans, God had chosen to reveal himself to them. Let's think about that some more. We are accustomed to connect communication from God with divinely authorized and usually morally good and Jewish spokesmen of God. Though that's usually the case, it's not always the case. Moses and Joshua, both chosen by God, were generally good men, and so were the writing prophets and the great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Generally speaking, God revealed himself through this kind of men, generally speaking. There are, though, instances of God speaking or of God acting to or through other individuals, some of them less than savory characters, like Jehu, the king of Israel, whom God used to put an end to Baal worship and to Baal worshipers, like Balaam, who, though he repeatedly professed to do only what God wanted, nevertheless caused Israel to stumble, like Babylon, the nation who would conquer Judah and Jerusalem, who would lead its inhabitants into captivity and then eventually destroy the Holy Temple. Does God use less than perfect people, or less than perfect nations, and less than perfect circumstances to accomplish his will? Yes. In fact, with the exception of Jesus, everyone and every nation that God works through has been less than perfect. But that's not the whole story. God also uses people who are antithetical to, who are opposed to his will, and who ardently teach, support, and engage in beliefs and practices that God has condemned, like Jehu, like Babylon. And then there are others who, though not the traditional prophets or spokesmen that we are used to seeing in God's Word, there are others that are still useful. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, was never described as a divinely ordained prophet, yet he gave valuable advice to his son-in-law. In Genesis, Abimelech and Pharaoh, the one that Abraham met, not the one that Joseph knew, were both divinely warned of God, and, with God's approval, apparently rebuffed Abraham. Gamaliel, who we will see later in our studies, gave advice that spared the apostles from death. So yes, God could, and God evidently did, use pagan magi from the east to introduce Herod and Jerusalem to the birth of Jesus. And one more thought here, just in case you missed it. The magi were pagan, meaning that they were not Jews. That's not the first time that non-Jewish souls figured prominently in Matthew's gospel. Remember Rahab? Remember Ruth? Both in the seed line of Christ as recorded in Matthew chapter 1. though a gospel heavily connected to Old Testament principles and prophets and their corresponding New Testament fulfillments, Matthew references Gentile involvement frequently. That would have included the Magi. Verse 2 tells us why these wise men came to Jerusalem. They came saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." They had seen his star, the star of the one who has been born King of the Jews, and they had come to worship him. We raised several questions earlier, questions which we will repeat here with little to no answer. Why little to no answer? First, it's not because we do not want answers. We always want answers to our questions. Second, it's because the questions are easy and numerous, but the answers are never or rarely easy. And answers, with air quotes around it, answers tend to be more speculation than solution sometimes. Here are the questions. Who were these wise men? What does it mean to say that they were from the east? Why did they come to Jerusalem? What about the star? Where did it come from? What prompted these wise men to follow this star? How did the star lead them? And what does all of this mean? Rather than raise more questions, let's attempt to state what appears to be more definitive than speculation. There was a common belief in that day that heavenly activity presaged parallel changes on earth, usually understood to affect or to predict the rise or fall of world leaders. Allen, in his commentary, notes this: "The widespread expectation of the birth of a great monarch in the West led the Magi to connect some particular star or conjunction of heavenly bodies with his birth. Just so, on the birth night of Alexander," here referring to Alexander the Great, "just so on the birth night of Alexander, Magi prophesied from a brilliant constellation that the destroyer of Asia was born." End of citation by Allen. Scholars and scientists have suggested several naturalistic explanations for the appearance of this star: the confluence of two planets, Jupiter and Saturn, or meteors, falling stars, or a comet. Halley's Comet, however, passed by several years earlier. Matthew's treatment, however, approaches the event as supernatural, divinely supernatural. This text, Matthew chapter 2 and the opening verse, tells us, first, that the wise men saw this star, thus prompting their journey, chapter 2, verse 2. Second, that it apparently led them to Jerusalem, but no further, again, chapter 2, verse 2. Third, thus prompting them to ask in Jerusalem about the location of Christ's birth, again, chapter 2, verse 2. Fourth, that they were able to identify when it appeared to Herod, chapter 2, verse 7. Fifth, that the star reappeared after speaking with Herod, this indicated by the word "behold" in the context, chapter 2, verse 9. Sixth, that the star finally led them to where the young child was, chapter 2, verse 9. And seventh, that the reappearance of the star in Jerusalem that took them on the final leg of their journey brought them great joy, chapter 2, verse 10. Let's note the circumstances and the events that are presented here. We note the appearance of the star. We note the disappearance of the star. And we also note the reappearance of the star. We observe the input from the chief priests and the scribes about Micah's prophecy. We witness the concern of Herod. We see their divine direction after they visited the young child. Notice that they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod in chapter 2, verse 12. And we see their final arrival in the town of Bethlehem, chapter 2, verse 11. All of this indicates God's providential guidance. Additionally, though not specifically addressed in the text, the mechanics of how the star led them first to Jerusalem and then second to the very location where they would find the young child with Mary his mother, that also evidences divine guidance. A star's elevation in the sky allows for viewers to assume that it's directly above them, even though they may be in different places. Yet, this star led these men directly to Jerusalem first, and then, in some way, specifically to the place where Jesus was. Interestingly, Balaam, whom we referenced earlier as an example of a prophet, note the air quotes, that was less than what we usually understand prophets to be, that Balaam apparently prophesied of this event. Consider Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, where we read these words, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel, and batter the brow of Moab, and destroy all the sons of tumult." The question that the Magi asked, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" as we noted earlier in our study together, certainly caught Herod's attention. Remember, Herod was given that title by the Roman Senate. What authority could possibly have made someone else, a child, the king of the Jews? Consider Blomberg's remarks here. The Magi's question to Herod emphasizes the word born. The grammatical construction makes it clear that they ask about who the child is who has legitimate claim to Israel's throne by virtue of his birth. Herod is thus viewed as a usurper to the throne. End of citation from Blomberg. Did you see that? The wise men sought a child who was, by his very birth, the king of the Jews. That certainly did not apply to Herod. Herod was not a Jew, but an Idumean, a descendant of Esau, or Edom. He could not have been born king of the Jews unless his father was a king of the Jews. Though he could have been made or crowned king by the Jews, even that would not have equaled being born king. And no Roman Senate could ever, by fiat, simply declare him to be king of the Jews by birth. In our next broadcast, we will take up at this point and continue our study of Matthew chapter 2. A reminder as we close, if you would like to receive our free 30-lesson series, Studies in the Bible, call this toll-free number 1-855-IGH-6988 or use the contact form at internationalgospelhour.com. Just leave your name and mailing address, and we will get those lessons to you right away. We hope that you can join us as we study God's Word together in our next broadcast.